Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app.
Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Halper.
I'm the other host, Aaron Mate. Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for being here. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and get bonus content. This week, we are joined by a wonderful guest, Scott Horton, who has a brand new book. It's called Provoked: How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. And we'll be speaking to Scott about that whole catastrophe in Ukraine and a whole lot more, because luckily for us, we're involved in so many catastrophes around the world, right, from Ukraine to the Middle East. And Scott has a lot to say on these topics.
And make sure, if you don't already, support us. If you're not already members at usefulidiotspodcast.com, make sure you do become members, because Scott has some really interesting things to say about Israel in the bonus portion of the interview. And of course, as always, you get the Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness. So, so many reasons to give yourself the gift of our podcast extended membership.
All right, let's get to our four basic food groups, starting with Democrats suck. Antony Blinken, our outgoing Secretary of State, is making the rounds. And with just 1 month left of the Biden presidency, it's time to reflect. It's time to reflect on a job well done for a guy whose job is supposed to be a diplomat, but has spent his time promoting war, whether it's in Ukraine or when it comes to Gaza, facilitating an outright genocide. So Antony Blinken recently did an event at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City. And he was asked to reflect on how historians will look back on the Biden administration's foreign policy. And this is some of what Antony Blinken had to say.
The other side of the coin, the part that we've been responsible for, has been to really re-engage, re-energize, rejuvenate, and in many ways reimagine our alliances and partnerships. And as I sit here today, I feel confident that even with all of the problems you listed, it makes you wonder why anyone would want this job. We're actually in a much stronger position than we were to contend with them, because we're stronger at home, because we've restored and in many ways rethought our partnerships around the world.
We've re-engaged, re-energized, rejuvenated, restored, and rethought. That's a lot of
verbs.
A lot of verbs. And I didn't hear anything concrete in terms of what we actually did. It's right. A lot of he sounds like a self-help leader about rejuvenating and re-energizing your life, not being a diplomat whose job is to avoid conflict, not fuel it. And how he can sit there and claim that we're in a stronger position when you have the world on fire, I think in large part due to the job he's done, which is to promote war rather than end it. That's beyond me.
Yeah, well, I like the way, in certain ways, Aaron, I'm going to give him credit for thinking outside the box, right? Like, he is a diplomat, but he does more kind of warmongering. He is a diplomat, but he does more kind of self-help guidance. Yeah. So maybe that's how he'll be remembered, as a visionary, as a trailblazer.
Like, is anybody feeling rejuvenated and re-energized at the sight of Gaza being destroyed? I mean, if you're like a
sadist.
If you're a sadist, yes, I guess you're rejuvenated at the sight of Gaza destroyed, children starving, people, you know, tens of thousands of people murdered. But aside from sadists, I don't see how you can feel as if the world's come out stronger and rejuvenated because of the job he's done.
Yeah, I feel like I've been getting such R&R, such good R&R with this genocide. Feel really refreshed. It's disgusting. Well, we also have warmongers, obviously, on the other side of the aisle. And, you know, Trump does like to run as an anti-war kind of iconoclast, but he's not one of those. And he makes his support of Israel very, very clear, and also warmongering in Syria. So here he is speaking at Mar-a-Lago on Fox News, and he remembers the days that he bombed Syria. And claims, in contrast to previous comments, that he doesn't understand why Russia is involved. Let's take a look.
I can say that Assad was a butcher. What he did to children. You remember, I attacked him with the 58 missiles. Unbelievable missiles coming from ships 700 miles away, and every one of them hit their target. But I did that. That was the red line in the sand. Obama drew it, and then he refused to honor what he did. He said, if anybody goes across the red line, and Assad killed many more children after that, and Obama did nothing, but I did. I hit him with a lot of missiles. In fact, President Xi was sitting here the night he was in that dining room having chocolate cake. Remember the famous chocolate cake? But and that's when I explained what we were doing as the missiles were shot. And it was amazing as to precision, because every one of those missiles hit its target from a long distance away. Had President Obama drawn the line and where it meant something, you wouldn't have even had Russia there. But in the end, I never understood why Russia went there. They were not getting very much out of it.
So that is an interesting shift, as Michael Tracy points out, from Trump in 2015 when he said about Russia, they're going to do some bombing of ISIS, which, frankly, I think is a great thing. Let Russia bomb ISIS.
You know, Trump, who's not known for being so attentive to details, knew a lot of details there in his fond memory of the president of China eating chocolate cake while Trump bombed Syria. It's interesting what memory he can hang on to. And he certainly is obviously very proud of the fact that he bombed Syria. And nice to see him reminiscing.
Right.
Over a great time in his presidency, and I'm sure he's looking forward to many more bombing opportunities now that he's coming back into office.
It kind of reminds me of, remember when Nancy Pelosi was speaking to Hillary Clinton, and they were talking about how all roads lead to Putin, and Nancy was like, "You remember that blue dress I was wearing, right? We all remember that blue dress."
That's when she stood up to Donald Trump at a meeting, right, and pointed a finger at him and said, "With you, all roads lead to Putin." And then we're all supposed to cheer. That is some brave moment where Trump is finally being, you know, called out for his,
right,
his secret conspiracy with Putin. And that's like how we're supposed to resist him, is embodied by Nancy Pelosi
in her blue dress, which we're all supposed to remember.
Yes.
Much,
yes,
like, well, the chocolate cake.
The chocolate cake. Yes.
Yeah. And at that same press event, Trump had some interesting things to say about his discussions with Netanyahu.
We had a very good talk. We discussed what is going to happen, and I'll be very available on January 20th, and we'll see. I, as you know, I gave warning that if these hostages aren't back home by that date, all hell's going to break out, and very strong. But we generally just discussed, I asked him, where are things? Mike Waltz is, they're doing a great job, by the way. Everybody is very happy. I think he's doing a fantastic job. But he was very much involved in the call. But it was a recap call more than anything else.
So much for Trump forcing Israel to end the war, as many people were predicting he would do.
Yeah, I mean, if Trump really is serious about that warning about how the hostages have to be returned, he should be pressuring Netanyahu to finally,
exactly,
make the deal he's been avoiding. But of course, he's not. It's not what he's referring to. He's saying it's all on Hamas. And again, we don't know how many captives have been killed by Israeli strikes at this point. There's constantly speculation that more are dying in these unending Israeli bombings, which of course continue to massacre Palestinian civilians. It's become so normalized now to see just dozens of dead Palestinian civilians. And we're all supposed to just accept that as normal. Trump certainly has, because he never criticizes it.
Right. All right. What do we got for Isn't That Weird?
Isn't That Weird? Let's turn to arguably the weirdest story in U.S. politics today. And that is the mysterious drones over New Jersey, which, you know, after a long time now, no one can give an answer for as to what these drones are. Well, one lawmaker does have an answer. And his name is Doug Mastriano. He is a state senator from Pennsylvania, a Republican. And he recently came out with this. He says, it is inconceivable that the federal government has no answers nor has taken any action to get to the bottom of the unidentified drones. And just to underscore how serious this is, he posted a picture alongside his complaint. It's a very serious aircraft that has been apparently found and hoisted on a truck. The one problem, though, is that the picture is that not of a drone that was over New Jersey, but of a an aircraft that is used in the movie Star Wars. It's a spaceship, either a prop from the film or a replica of a spaceship used in Star Wars, as people on Twitter pointed out. So,
well, I mean, that's one theory, but maybe it actually is not a mistake, but that it's actually what's happening. I mean, it could be an actual Star Wars invasion.
So whoever these Martians are, rather than fly their own aircraft, they've either built a replica of the Star Wars aircraft or they've stolen the aircraft used in the Star Wars movie franchise, repurposed them to actually fly in space. Another flying over New Jersey. Well,
or Star Wars is a documentary. And this is actually like Darth Vader people.
Well, who knows at this point? Who knows in this crazy world what is real and fictional anymore? But the senator from Pennsylvania, that's his contribution. And of course, there are other Republicans who have said things like this came from an Iranian mothership. So people are going to all kinds of leaps from Star Wars to Iran. And still, though, we don't have a concrete answer as to what's going on. But I'm sure if we keep coming up with theories like this, we'll get closer.
Well, speaking of fact and fiction, people probably remember that we showed you a video of Clarissa Ward of CNN, quote unquote, discovering the last prisoner at one of Assad's prisons. And we thought we, along with many other people on the internet, thought that it looked a little suspicious, didn't really look authentic, didn't look like an actual prisoner, someone who had been locked up for years and was the last person to be released for various reasons. Well, we have an update on that story. Let's take a listen to Sky News.
Now, the broadcast crew were filming in an empty prison when they stumbled upon what appeared to be the only locked cell in the secret facility. Rescued a victim of Assad's brutal regime, except he wasn't a victim at all. The man they set free was later identified as Salama Mohammed Salama, one of Assad's most brutal lieutenants, responsible for the savage torture of civilians.
He clutches my arm tightly with both hands.
So I guess that's an example of some terrible reporting from CNN. And it is pretty terrible. It was terrible enough acting or terrible enough props and costume design and hair and makeup, I would say, that most people saw through it. And here's Clarissa Ward in her own words explaining what happened.
So what do we know about this man now?
Well, Jake, obviously, from the minute we witnessed this astonishing moment, we're trying to dig up more information on this prisoner. We weren't able to find anything with the name he gave us, Adil Khurbal. But in the days after our report aired, CNN started talking to people in the city of Homs who told us that his real name is, in fact, Salama Mohammed Salama. He is reportedly a lieutenant in the Air Force Intelligence Directorate. He is also known as Abu Hamza. He was known
So look, she's admitting right here that they aired this segment of the supposedly, you know, freed political prisoner without checking who he was.
Right.
So she's acknowledging it. Yeah, she's acknowledging that she didn't do journalism, right. Which of course she's not going to like articulate, but that's what the admission is. Like she they aired this segment. They saw it as like some great huge moment that they had uncovered, and she was thinking probably I'm going to win some big award for this. So let's just rush it out there without fact checking it. And then days later, finally, after everybody mocked her for it, that's when they started fact checking.
Right. And it's interesting because she presents it like this is due diligence to check after you stream. Of course, it's the opposite. Yeah.
Yes. We all know in journalism, you put out a story and then you fact check it afterwards.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
run Air Force intelligence checkpoints in the city of Homs. He's accused of extorting and harassing people. And we have now been able to corroborate the information those residents gave us with a photograph of Salama. And it's clear that far from being an ordinary guy, as he presented himself to be, he was a part of Bashar.
I love the chyron. CNN follows up on prisoner relief. Right. No, CNN gets caught putting out a fake story. And now is trying to backtrack in the most like cowardly way because they're not taking ownership of the fact that they did not do their due diligence.
Do you think there's any way they thought this was real?
I don't know what goes on the minds of these people. I mean, Clarissa Ward is notorious for putting out stunts, for putting out regime change propaganda. So I don't think thoughts like this cross her mind. She's just doing her job, which is to be a propagandist.
Right. Well, you know, I do want to give her I do want to congratulate her because she managed to actually unite both sides of the Syrian conflict, because you had people who were both Assad supporters and Assad haters who were outraged by this. So maybe that's what's needed to bring the country back together. She's actually doing
peace, doing bad journalism.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. Yeah. Clarissa Ward's rare contribution to humanity.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And those have been your four basic food groups. For this week's interview, we are joined by Scott Horton. He is host of The Scott Horton Show and author of the brand new book, Provoked: How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. And just to set the scene, you know, a theme of this interview is that so much of what was previously dismissed as Russian propaganda is now admitted out in the open, you know, such as the fact that there was a peace deal negotiated between Ukraine and Russia right after Russia invaded in February 2022, but that the US and UK stood in the way and prevented this deal from going through. When people like us pointed that out when it was happening, that was called Russian propaganda. Now there's so much evidence that it's hard to dismiss that as Russian propaganda anymore. And another example of this is the fact that this is called the proxy war.
Right.
When critics of the Ukraine proxy war were called a proxy war, that was also dismissed as Russian propaganda. But let's hear from one of the chief proxy warriors himself, Boris Johnson, who was the British prime minister when Russia invaded. And he's the one who famously went over to Zelensky and told him not to finalize that peace deal that Ukraine had negotiated with Russia in the early months of the war. Listen to how Boris Johnson recently described the war in Ukraine.
We are, Nate, let's face it, we're waging a proxy war. We're waging a proxy war, but we're not giving our proxies the ability to do the job. And for years and years now, we've been allowing them to fight with one hand tied behind their backs. And it has been cruel. It has been cruel. And we need now to give them what they need. So
according to Boris Johnson, we're waging a proxy war using Ukraine, but that part it's not cruel to use Ukraine to fight a proxy war. It's cruel that we're not giving all the weapons possible to fight that proxy war. That's the Boris Johnson perspective. And that is the perspective that Scott Horton takes apart in his new book, Provoked, a very detailed account of the U.S. role in provoking the proxy war in Ukraine and prolonging it ever since. So we're going to hear now from Scott Horton talking about the war in Ukraine and also the crisis in the Middle East, which he also has a lot of thoughts about. This is our interview with Scott Horton. Scott Horton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, both of you.
The book is called Provoked: How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. This book is a huge achievement. First of all, you are just so comprehensive in your history of the war in Ukraine, going far beyond, you know, Ukraine itself to all the other areas in which, you know, in your telling, the U.S. has basically provoked Russia and caused this new Cold War that we're in. So just starting with a very broad question, just talk to us about your aim with this book. And what you think is most important for people to understand about the background to the proxy war in Ukraine? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you again, both of you, so much for having me. And I have to say, Aaron, this is no fault of your own, but the whole time I was writing this book, you are like a ghost. Because I know you're like hovering over me, haunting me, because I know that you're writing a book about this too. And I know that you are such a great journalist. I, of course, cite you in my book over and over again on so many different issues from, well, obviously, especially on Russiagate, but on all different stuff. And you're just so good on things that I literally had to stop reading your Substack, because every time I do, I think, oh my God, this guy's going to think I'm ripping him off when my book comes out and he reads it. Cause what I have to say is so close to what you have to say all the time. And yeah. I've just been terrified that your book was going to come out before mine. And that then I even had a plan. I know I'm crazy, but I had a plan. As soon as your book comes out, I'm going to send you a copy of my document. And I'm going to say, look, dude, this is what I have so far. I swear to God, I'm not plagiarizing your book when I have all the same stuff as you. And I, because I just have been terrified, and only as like friendly competition, right? Like, I'm the second best skater at the ramp, dude. And I'm just trying to measure up to you is all, really. But you're just a huge inspiration to me. You're great journalism and all that. So, I mean, my fear I describe is in the highest and best of spirit of admiration for what you do. And
that's very kind. This is the problem when you can count on like two hands, the amount of people who tell the truth about these major conflicts is that, you know, it seems to be like, it's like a commodity, who can actually get out the facts. And so therefore the few people who do, like, you think, you know, that they're all sort of like in concert, when really it's just such a small, if like we had a media that did its job, it wouldn't be a competition to see who can get out the truth first, because everybody would do it.
Yeah, seriously. And of course, this whole time, as everyone has been doing such a great job opposing the war, I've been saving up all of my great work in one big Word document and not showing it to anyone until now. Right. So it's all in there, but you had to wait until now to get it. So there you go. And I should talk about this too, because I think this is so cool. I didn't know about this. This guy, Jonathan Haslam, is a professor at Harvard. And he's written this book called Hubris. Now, this is the English version, which doesn't have America in the subtitle because it's the English version. The American version doesn't come out till January, so I beat him too. But the book is called Hubris, The American Origins of Russia's War Against Ukraine. And it's the same book, only shorter and sweeter and better written, because it's by a real historian and a real writer who's done such a great job on it. But I'm reading it now, and it's also, you know, really great, but it has all kinds of stuff I didn't know. You know, quotes and facts and things that, you know, would tend to bolster my case, but that I was unaware of. So I'm having a great time reading that too. You know, my last book on the terror war came out about, 2 months or something after Max Blumenthal's book, The Management of Savagery, which is just the same book as my book, only told from his point of view instead of mine.
You're like on a gray zone track.
Yeah, seriously. Like, we're just great minds think alike kind of thing.
So there's evil ones, as my father always says, but that doesn't apply to you.
That's right. No, certainly not. I'm thrilled to just be in such great company. That's all I'm really trying to say here. So thank you. And I can't wait to read your book. I know it's going to absolutely kill on Russiagate and the war and everything, you know. Can't wait for it. And now I can start reading your Substack again. I already have. I was reading your Israel-Palestine stuff, but I wasn't reading any of your Ukraine stuff. That's a true story. I was like, man, I can't read this guy's stuff anymore. He's going to think that I'm just ripping him off. Anyway, sorry.
Well, let's get to your book. So you go through a very long history here, and it will be impossible for us to cover it all in this interview.
Yeah.
But I guess, I mean, for people who still, I mean, this war in Ukraine, the Russian invasion phase of this war in Ukraine, because, of course, the actual war began, you know, arguably 10 years ago with the Maidan coup. But for people who are still just not familiar with the basics, I mean, what do you think is most important to understand from a book like yours about this war?
Well, so I've been practicing, Aaron. I'm going to do the bullet pointiest version of this all the way through.
Yes. How many pages is your book? Seven?
It's 7 by 10. So it's only 690 pages.
Right.
When it's 6 by 9, which the next edition is going to, I got a different printer. It's going to be 6 by 9. The hardback's going to be 6 by 9. So that'll come in at 938. However, about a third of that is citations. When we took the URLs out of the citations, that saved 77 pages of just web addresses. So that's how thoroughly cited every claim is in there in the antiwar.com style for you. But so the super bullet points are, Yes, they promised not to expand NATO, then they did it anyway. They did the shock therapy, economic policy. They did the Balkan Wars, and they did missile defense, color-coded revolutions, and especially the promises to expand NATO all the way into Ukraine and Georgia. And then, of course, with the color-coded revolutions, the biggest and most important of those is the one you already mentioned, was the overthrow of the government in 2014, which led to the loss of Crimea and the outbreak of war in the East. And the unresolved nature of that conflict is probably the single most important factor in causing the current war. But I think importantly for people's, you know, recent memory here, in Joe Biden's first year, it was decided, I think, by spring, by the Russians, that they were coming. And I think the Americans started to get that idea. And they decided that what they would do is that they would tell the Russians, you better not, but that they would not really engage in any negotiation in good faith, because that would be appeasement, like when Neville Chamberlain gave in to Hitler. And honestly, I hate to say this, guys, because it sounds like I'm giving them an out. Like when I used to talk about George Bush being stupid and people say, I'm making excuses for him as though now he's not as responsible for his choices or something like that. But the thing is, Joe Biden is stupid. He's always been stupid. And the people around him also all are stupid. And if you listen to them talk, the reason that they reach for these cheap historical analogies is because they actually don't know anything about it. So instead they go, well, this is just like Neville Chamberlain and Hitler, which they don't actually know anything about that either. But they know that you're supposed to be Churchill and not Chamberlain. And so that's basically the deal. The other metaphor they all reach for, these dorks, they're always pretend in the analogy like they are the all-star on the baseball team, you know, hero here, but they're the dork in the analogy. And what they always say is, it's just like in the schoolyard, you have to punch the bully in the nose to make him stop. And the thing is, they were never the tough guy, but good guy in the neighborhood who punched the bully in the nose. They were always the cowering dork who needed the good guy to save them. So that's their outlook on life. You listen to these people, that's how they all talk about these issues. And so for Joe Biden, his position in 21 was to threaten Putin, but never to negotiate with him in any good faith. And
as the cold weather hits, we all feel that looming pressure to buy a whole new wardrobe as temperatures and fashion trends change. Here's the problem. So many of those fast fashion companies churn out low-quality clothes that will be tattered and out of style by next year, creating an endless cycle of buying, buying, and buying. But we found a solution: timeless, American-made clothes that never go out of style. And we're getting them from American Giant. You'll never need to restock again. American Giant obsesses over every detail of their clothes, so you know you're getting the best. We're wearing American Giant. You should too. This season, snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The most frustrating part of this, truly, is that Biden himself, and he is the president for as demented as he is, he never meant to bring Ukraine into NATO, and he said so repeatedly.
That's right.
He also never meant to install missile defense systems in Ukraine, which can be, you know, they're dual-use launchers that can host Tomahawk cruise missiles. He never intended to do that either, and he said both of those things in his December 30th phone call with Putin, but he refused to put it in writing. He refused to sit down and send, you know, high-level diplomats, Tony Blinken, go over there and hash this thing out with Lavrov and let's just do it. And, you know, there were quotes, I guess anonymous quotes, but still from administration officials to the Post and the Times saying that Putin's proposed treaty is not that unreasonable. Of course, they're not just going to sign on the bottom line, but it was not a deal that was made to be rejected like Madeleine Albright's Rambouillet Accord, right, where it's this a deal you must refuse. It was not that. It was potentially the basis for real negotiations. But what happened? They had this stupid open door policy, which said, we're not going to bring Ukraine into NATO, but you can't tell us that we're not going to bring Ukraine into NATO. So if we were going to put that in writing now, then that would be because you're holding a gun to our head and we'll never let that happen. We'd rather see a few hundred thousand Ukrainians die and extend a war for a few years than to give in to extortion on this Hitlerian level, was how they portrayed it. And I think how they understood it themselves. And so, and then as you guys, I know, are well familiar, they announced from the very beginning, they told David Sanger of the New York Times, who's probably the most important guy on this type of a beat, highest ranking guy at the Times. And he said, the goal is to lock Russia into a long-term battle. That was the phrase, lock them in yep. to a long-term struggle in Ukraine.
Which into a quagmire.
That's right. So you would think all other 8 billion of us would think, no, stop, cease fire, negotiate, figure it out, end the war. Whatever it is, we can't have a hot war on Russia's border when they're holding on to thousands of nukes and you have Western powers, the superpower, world empire instigating it and all this stuff. We can't, we have to negotiate. And then, no, here we are. We're having this conversation almost 3 years later and Blinken hasn't talked to Lavrov at, virtually at all since then, other than short conversations over the release of the basketball player lady. And that's it. And I'm not saying that we're in danger of nuclear war, but I am saying that they have raised the risk of nuclear war by a significant degree and that they have absolutely no right to do so, especially not for such essentially diplomatic games that they're playing here with the Russians that it's totally unnecessary to do.
You raised a few points there that I want to just clarify for people who are not familiar with the details. So at the end of 2021, Putin and Biden had this phone call where, according to the Kremlin, Biden does say, we have no intention of putting offensive weaponry into Ukraine. And Russia says, great, this is good. This is the basis for more talks. And then so the following month, January 2022, there are more talks. But all of a sudden, the U.S. refuses to put that into writing, as Scott was just saying. And on the point about Ukraine, people might be confused because people think that the whole point of this war, from Russia's perspective, was to prevent Ukraine from getting into NATO. So that how is it then you're saying that Biden had no intention of bringing Ukraine into NATO? And my point there was that this open door to Ukraine was always a backdoor through which NATO could fight Russia. So you promise Ukraine this future membership, and under that pretense, you integrate Ukraine militarily into NATO without ever actually giving it the security guarantees right. of membership. And that's been the game that's been played from the start, that like they've always been dangling this future membership for Ukraine. But whenever Ukraine says, hey, can we come in now? The U.S. says no. And Joe Biden has said Ukraine's not ready. And yeah. it's like this combination of arrogance that the Russians aren't going to tell us what to do, but also cynicism is we're going to use this promise of future membership to keep integrating Ukraine into NATO's military infrastructure without actually giving Ukraine the security guarantees that will defend it when it gets attacked.
Right. So in other words, if it was deliberate, that would be a great way to bait Russia into a war.
Exactly.
And I'm not saying that it's deliberate. I'm saying it's Democrats doing their best, but this is their best is in effect. They yeah. were causing it. And you're absolutely right. They call it interoperability, where they're yeah. standardizing Ukraine's military, and they had just announced in September and again in November, the State Department and the Defense Department in 21 announced that, yeah, we're moving forward even further with that. So in other words, if NATO and Russia went to war, Ukraine's military would be just another auxiliary along with the rest of them, Hungary and Poland and Lithuania and whoever's militaries are in NATO, they would all be fighting under the NATO banner. Ukraine would be too. But then as you're saying, and I quote, numerous, you know, think tankers and university experts and whatever in the book calling this the worst of both worlds for Ukraine, where it really is. Let's you and him fight. But no, I'm not promising to jump in. I'm promising that one day I'll promise to jump in. But right now, I'm not promising that. But still, you and him fight. And which is really unfair to do.
The verbiage that Blinken and others in the Biden administration came up to justify this, they talked about how we've given Ukraine an irreversible invitation and we've given Ukraine a well-lit bridge toward NATO, but we're never actually giving Ukraine the information it needs on what it can do to actually join NATO. So just because you invite someone to something, like even if the invitation is irreversible, it doesn't matter if you're not actually going to let them in. So right. Like just the language they use to like avoid giving Ukraine actual membership is just it speaks to just the cynicism involved here.
I'm curious. Let's say that Biden actually did care about Ukrainians. Let's say the Biden administration did care about Ukrainians. What would they have done differently?
OK, well, so first of all, they're. In a way, they were trying to deter Russia, right? They were serious when they were saying, you better not. We're going to wage an economic war against you. We're going to pour weapons in. I think everyone assumed that the government would fall and that Russia would have the run of the place, but it's a big country. It's about the size of Texas. And we could arm up an insurgency from neighboring states and replicate the Afghan model and the Syria model. It was unbelievable. They're invoking Afghanistan 3 months after America's humiliating defeat and withdrawal from the consequences of that one. And after, you know, just a couple of years after they built a caliphate and had to destroy it again. And they're invoking these two wars as the model. So I think they were trying to make him think twice about it. In that sense, they were trying to deter it. And, you know, I quote, and I'm sorry, I got a better, more specific answer to that, but I wanted to bring up this one anecdote here that there's a guy named Zach Dorfman, a journalist for Yahoo News, Zach Dorfman. And he did this series about the CIA and Ukraine right at the eve of the war. And in one of those, he quotes CIA officers. And these were the guys apparently who were on the ground in Ukraine. And their job was to receive the weapons and distribute them to Ukraine's armed services and whatever, make sure they go where they're supposed to go, whatever. They're the American, you know, middlemen receiving the weapons for Ukraine, essentially. And he quotes them saying, like, it's almost like they're quoting me, but I'm quoting them. But like, yeah, they're saying, listen, the calibration is off. The measurement, what we're trying to do is pour in enough weapons to deter Russia from attacking. But we're not doing that. In fact, we're pouring in enough weapons to incentivize them to attack sooner than later. And so these CIA officers claimed, believably, that they were telling their bosses to tell the politicians, we should be dialing this down, not up right now. You're making it worse, not better. They could tell from their position. This is what libertarians in economics call the knowledge problem, where these central government officials 7,000 miles away in Washington, D.C., they can't really know. They have their best guesses as to what's going on. And apparently they're not listening to their own agents on the ground who are trying to give them better advice. So from you could totally see this from Blinken and Sullivan and Biden's thing. Well, we're just going to keep pouring weapons in there and let those Russians know they better not, because that's how they finish that sentence. And let those Russians know they better not. That's just how they conceive of the whole thing. So it's to them totally counterintuitive if you're saying, no, you're the one making the war happen by doing this. But there's this great professor, I forget his name, I'm sorry, but I quote him in the book, and he's a professor in England who wrote a thing called Now or Never. And he also was not taking Russia's side. He's not justifying it. Just like my title of my book is Provoked, not Good Job, you know, and he's saying the Americans put them in the position of deciding, well, we better do it now or we're going to have to do it later anyway. Only later it'll be harder. So we should go now. And that was essentially the position that the Americans were putting them in, boxing them into a corner or at least against the wall where they decide, let's go ahead and fight now instead of waiting till our back is all the way in a corner. And so that was what they did. I really don't believe that Biden was trying to start this war. I think that the Afghan model was plan B. Plan A was you better not. But plan B should have been sit down and talk and come up with a new treaty and be tough enough about it to make it look good and do it. But nope, they wouldn't do that. So instead, plan B was to lock them in to this quagmire, this struggle. And by the way, for skeptics, Sarah got plenty of quotes showing all the way through of people who don't remember that period or weren't paying attention or whichever narrow sources all through the early spring or in the spring of 2022, we have numerous statements from American officials saying that this is the policy, including the Secretary of State and Defense, saying the policy is to prolong the war as long as we can, which again, to all 8 billion other Earthlings, ought to sound like the most insane thing they ever heard anybody say. It's the most reckless policy maybe in all of American history. I mean, for all of Kennedy and Reagan's brinksmanship, they never played games this crazy with the Soviet Union the way Joe Biden is acting right now.
And I think it's Jeffrey Roberts, by the way, I believe is the.
That sounds right.
Yeah. At University of Cork. Anyway.
And if you want more proof that the U.S. goal was to prolong the war and have a proxy war, then you have the fact that you had peace talks immediately begin after Russia invades between Russia and Ukraine. But the U.S. and the U.K. opposed the deal that they reached in Istanbul. And on this point, we actually just got yet one more inside source confirming this. We played the clip so many times of Ukrainian officials saying this, of others saying this. Now we have John Daniel Roosh, who was Switzerland's ambassador to Turkey at the time of these negotiations in the spring of 2022, and Turkey is where the talks were held. And he just came out and said that the Americans with their British allies, quote, pulled the plug on the negotiations when they were on the edge of succeeding. And he says the reason is they wanted to first weaken Russia. And he calls this deeply immoral. So this is just yet one more insider coming forward to reveal what we've been talking about for a long time, that there was a peace deal very close to fruition, but the US and UK stood in the way because their goal was not peace and security. It was a proxy war through which they could weaken Russia. But let me ask you, Scott, you have a chapter on how Russia... I mean, although you argue, of course, they were provoked, as you just said, you don't think they were justified. And you go through, you know, your view on what Russia could have done as an alternative mm-hmm. to invading Ukraine. And this is a point of contention, you know, some people who are very critical of the U.S. role in Ukraine, who basically say that Russia had no choice but to invade. That's not your argument. And so I'd be curious to hear, what you think could have been an alternative from Russia's perspective to invading Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. I actually cite you right in that paragraph too, because you were really great on this right at that time in saying so. And I forget which of these ideas was yours. I guess it was bringing in new peacekeepers, UN peacekeepers from a third country to stand there. And then I had a couple ideas, which the first one was just cut off the gas to all of Western Europe immediately, 100%. Yep. And tell them, look, man, I mean, like the economic shock that would have caused to Western Europe at the time, that would have been severe hardball. You really going to let Joe Biden put you in this situation and go ahead and look, you're going to kill a few hundred thousand people. Then you can find other ways to play hardball short of that. Right. Yep. So cutting off the gas. Look, and that's collective punishment of civilians. And it's not pretty at all. I'm certainly not recommending that. But short of war, it's certainly something that Putin could have done. Another thing is he could have just said, well, screw you. I'm vetoing everything on the UN Security Council until I have my way and get those peacekeepers that Aaron Matei recommended. And by the way, because this was a deal, as you have correctly pointed out in your journalism in the past, this was an issue on the table in 2018 in the UN Security Council. And the Russians were pushing for this. But the Americans, of course, were essentially still demanding that Minsk II be implemented in reverse order first. And only then can you have your peacekeepers, which that was kind of the whole point of the peacekeepers was let's find another way to get the Minsk II deal jump-started. The Russians are not going to abandon their border posts and turn the whole border, the eastern border of Ukraine, over to Ukrainian military forces before they allow elections and all of this stuff. which was the new Ukrainian and American interpretation of the deal. So they kept, and by the way, you know, when the Germans would say, well, we never meant to implement Minsk II, we were just giving them time to rearm. I believe other people when they say that, but in fact, Angela Merkel's government was trying to come up with ways, creative ways to get Minsk II implemented, because she was, I think, terrified that this war was going to break back out again. And there was a thing called the Steinmeier formula, which was her foreign minister saying, well, look, what if we put the order of operations for implementing Minsk II in this order? And then that way that should be agreeable to everyone. And the new president, Zelensky, who had just won, this is in 2019, he had just won running on peace. He's a Russian speaker from not the Far East, but the eastern half of the country. And he had run on peace and crushed his predecessor, Poroshenko, on that. But then the Nazis held rallies all through the fall of 19 into December called the No to Capitulation rallies, where they let Zelensky know that if he would negotiate with Russia, that was to them sacrificing and betraying all of the martyrs who died in the recent war already. And that if he did that, then they would blow his head off with rifle bullets. And so then he said, oh, yeah, you know what? Actually, I don't agree with the Steinmeier formula at all. And then that was it. And in fact, this calls back to your great interview with Stephen Cohen, where he says, you know what, Aaron, what we could do right now is we could provide this guy some bodyguards and we could help him round up Beletsky and Yarosh and the leaders of the Nazi groups there and get him out of that immediate danger so that he could pursue peace. Well, guess who wasn't watching your show that day? Everybody with power and influence, right? And so what happened instead was they did not do that. And this is a constant theme throughout the book where they all know better the whole time and they do it anyway. And that means not just people who I cite as like the greatest and wisest, like Ron Paul and Ted Galen Carpenter and Pat Buchanan and others who saw what was coming and warned, but who were already sort of, you know, I don't want to say fringe political characters, but not representing the mainstream of the foreign policy consensus, that's for sure. But those that did represent the mainstream of the foreign policy consensus, they knew better too. And they all said so all along when they first started expanding NATO, 2/3 of the Council on Foreign Relations was against it. And I'm almost certain this is right, that once they lost Crimea, 2/3 of the Council on Foreign Relations said, yeah, we kind of provoked this. Right. They did like an anonymous survey of CFR members and said, yeah, we were the ones who kind of made this happen. Unfortunately, they're willing to admit. And even Brzezinski and Kissinger and the leaders of the NATO expanders had said at various times, of course, we'll have to make a special case for Ukraine. The Baltic states? No. America never even recognized Soviet sovereignty over the Baltic states throughout the whole Cold War. America did recognize the so-called republic status of Belarus and Ukraine, but America always, at least rhetorically, only rhetorically, stood by the independence of the Baltic states. So that was going to be one thing. But Ukraine, man, we know how the Russians feel about that because, of course, the millions of ethnic Russians in the far east of the country, which had belonged to Russia for a few hundred years, couple of hundred years at least, had only been given to the communists by Lenin in 1921 and Crimea by Khrushchev in 54. And so, and Crimea, where their all important Black Sea fleet is based at the Sevastopol base, where it's been since the 1780s, went before, you know, right around the time America's constitution was being written. And so we know better than to pick that fight. So what we should do is they had the model from the last Cold War, Austria and Finland. We had established neutrality for both of these countries so that we don't fight over them. And look at a map of Europe. I mean, Austria is right in the thick of things. We could have a fight over Austria or not. And they decided not to. And so we could do the same thing here. And this goes back to, if you want to go back to even earlier proposals where the Americans really were shining the Russians on, they didn't ever really mean this. But what they told them was that we're going to make NATO into a political organization. It'll be sort of like the EU plus America. But it won't really even be a military alliance anymore because there's no enemy. We don't need an alliance. Instead, we're going to have a security partnership with you, our Russian friends, under the CSCE. And then later, and that became the OSCE. The second proposal was the Partnership for Peace. And so then Russia and Ukraine and Belarus and the Baltics and all of the in-between states can all join at the same time. And then we're all in a partnership together and everyone's neutrality is guaranteed. It's baked in that we have nothing to fight about because Russia's on the inside too. But then they didn't do that. They were really just telling the Russians that to get them to acquiesce and make it easier for the Americans to go ahead and expand and prevent them from taking measures to prevent it. But the whole time that they were doing that, the wisest of them said, geez, you see what we're doing? We're just moving the line east. We're not erasing dividing lines in Europe. We're just moving it further east. And in fact, in doing so, making the Russians feel threatened by our NATO alliance. And back to the early Biden or the early days of the war and right before the war in the Biden administration, early 22, we know from Derek Chollet, who is a longtime State Department functionary and think tank guy, sort of a Brookings Institute, Democratic Party, State Department guy. And he said, you know, going back to the Clinton years at least, and he said, look, we met with the Russians, but we would not put NATO membership for Ukraine on the table to discuss whatsoever at all. All we would say to them when it came to NATO is NATO is a defensive alliance. And that's all you need to know about it. And the fact that NATO launched an aggressive war in Serbia and in Libya and went around the UN Security Council to do so and launched a massive war that essentially was an aggressive war against the Taliban that did not attack us on September 11th in Afghanistan. They were under the pretension of defense in Article 5, but it was Al-Qaeda that did that. And they let Al-Qaeda escape. And they took the war to the Taliban and regime change in Kabul and a massive 20-year disaster of a war. But anyway, all you need to know about NATO is that it's a defensive alliance. Russians, you hear me? And that was the only thing they would say. They would certainly never negotiate neutrality for Ukraine, even though, again, the best of them wanted. I don't know if you remember this, Aaron, you might have been too young, but and Katie too. But in the lead up to Iraq War II, there was this liberal tag team, Pollock and O'Hanlon, Michael O'Hanlon and Ken Pollock. And they were sort of like the Democratic Party, Wolfowitz and Pearl or something. Crystal and Kagan. They're outside of government. They're the Democrats' answer to Crystal and Kagan, I guess.
Not Crystal Ball. William Crystal.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Bill Crystal. And not the comedian either, but the knacker. Irving's boy. Right. And some say my stepson now that I took property ownership of him at that debate in New York. But anyway, I lost my train of thought making fun of Bill Crystal.
In the lead up to the Iraq War II.
Oh yeah, in the lead up to Iraq War II, Pollock and O'Hanlon and Pollock, they were sort of the liberal guiding lights telling the rest of the liberal establishment, it's okay to support this war. We need to support this war. I think it was O'Hanlon who wrote the book, The Gathering Storm, but they were sort of twin brothers telling liberal Democrats to support Bush's war. That's their role in the world. Anyway, that guy, Pollock, not O'Hanlon, Pollock wrote, and I say this because it's like against interest. I'm saying a guy who is a very centrist foreign policy guy. I'm not saying see how illegitimate his ideas are. I'm saying he's a guy who fits in with them. And he did a monograph in 17, saying we need to ensconce permanent neutrality for Ukraine. We need to sit down and hash this out with the Russians right now before things get out of control. But as you would inform us in your new book coming out, the implication is obviously built right in there. This is the year of Russiagate. Okay, one of the 3 years of Russiagate, but a big one. And this is it. His book came out right at a time where nobody and certainly no Democrat wanted to hear an argument about how we need to negotiate in good faith with Russia about this crucial issue right now. Yep. People were living in total la-la land at that time, going completely crazy. And if Donald Trump, just like with the UN peacekeeper idea in 2018, he had no political juice or capital to make that happen because of the false accusations against him. He was just way too bogged down. So even when there was a workable plan, he just couldn't do anything about it. I don't know if you guys saw, there's a article by Keith Gessen in the New York Times where he quotes one of Trump's own guys, I believe it is, saying that when it comes to Russia policy, Trump is like the captain of a ship. He's holding the wheel, but it's not attached to anything. His government instead is driving.
Wanted to ask you about some of your thoughts on Syria and Israel. Mm-hmm. And the first question I have about Israel is a question that I ask to a lot of guests because there's a lot of debate about it. But What is it that makes the West, but the United States in particular, support Israel so unwaveringly? Is it Israel and the Israel lobby dictating U.S. foreign policy, or is it the U.S. using Israel for its own agenda?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
All right. Great to talk to Scott Horton again. His book is called Provoked: How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine.
Yeah. And, you know, he was wearing a Santa hat. And I think that's just a reminder of what a gift this this interview was. His showing up, his talking to us was like Santa giving us presents. And make sure that you give yourself the gift of Useful Idiots by joining us at usefulidiotspodcast.com, because then you'll hear the full interview with Scott Horton, which includes a very interesting analysis of the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. It's pretty spicy, if I do say so myself.
Our gratitude to Santa Scott Horton and to our audience for tuning in to the show. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.